Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler. My guest today is Scott Ritter. And Scott is going to talk about the American withdrawal from Afghanistan. Scott, you know, history should have taught us that there have been other countries that have gone into Afghanistan, namely the former Soviet Union, and they left in defeat. What gave the idea to the American presidency and people that they thought that they would be victorious in this quest?
Well, when we first went into Afghanistan, there it was not a mission to occupy the nation and transform the nation. It was purely a limited, frankly speaking, revenge-based mission to bring Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda and their what we called their Taliban enablers to justice, to destroy them, to remove them from power, to eliminate them as a threat capable of attacking American interests here in the United States or around the world. So, you know, that with that limited scope kind of mission, you know, there was a widespread belief that this was attainable without falling into the trap of, for instance, what the Soviet Union had done in getting bogged down in a nation-building, nation-transforming exercise. So we didn't start out thinking that we're going to be the ones that can change history. We're going to be the ones that can go into Afghanistan. We're going to be the ones that can emerge victorious, having transformed the Afghan state. That mission profile only came later.
So what made Americans think that we would be any different from the Russians? I mean, they got caught up in the quagmire. Didn't we learn from their mistakes?
Well, the interesting thing is anybody who was a student of the history of that region and a student of the Russian or the Soviet military involvement in Afghanistan, and I would also say Russian military involvement, because, you know, Afghanistan has historically been at the center of what was known as the Great Game, the geopolitical competition between Great Britain expanding northwards and eastwards out of India, and the Russians coming in south through central Central Asia, and Afghanistan was in the middle of that. And so, you know, it's not as though there wasn't a great deal of historical data about the reality of Afghanistan. Afghanistan isn't defined so much by a nation of like-minded people defining their own borders. It's defined by other nations trying to keep in what is in Afghanistan, which is an ungovernable tribal space. That's the history of it. And the Soviets found this out. I was an intelligence officer in the Soviet Union. I interviewed Soviet soldiers who had come back from Afghanistan. I was there when the Soviet Union left Afghanistan. I've read the memoirs. I've read the newspapers. I saw the Soviet take on this. And it was, you know, there is a plethora of data available about why it didn't work for the Soviets. And it all comes down to you cannot defeat a tribal-based society that doesn't want to change, that is resistant to change, that is willing to die to prevent you from changing. So we knew that. I mean, we knew that was the model that failed in the Soviet Union. Why we thought that we could be the ones now to come in and change this tribal-based society is beyond me. But the answer is simple. We stumbled into Afghanistan And then, you know, we had this incomplete mission. We were still trying to finish the job of hunting down Al-Qaeda, of weeding out the last vestiges of the Taliban, when George W. Bush decided we were going to shift gears and instead go to Iraq and engage in the invasion and occupation and nation-building exercise that became. And so we basically took all of our military forces out of Afghanistan, poured them into Iraq, and by the time we refocused on Afghanistan, the Taliban had reconstituted itself, first in Pakistan, creating a base of operations, and then back into the tribal areas, reasserting their authority. So we went from a purely counter-terrorism, counter-Al-Qaeda mission. Suddenly we were in the business of trying to transform tribal areas. And our politicians didn't have the courage to tell the American people, hey, we're not doing this. We're going to leave now, and we're going to leave Afghanistan to its own. No, Americans never like to admit defeat. Americans never like to say we can't do something, even though history is screaming it's an impossible task. And so George W. Bush started putting more and more troops in there. Obama came in, surged 30,000 troops, or more than that, 70,000 troops. And every president that has been involved in Afghanistan, including Donald Trump, put more troops in a desperate bid to change historical reality, to be the one who could emerge victorious. And I mean, I'll say this for Joe Biden: he from the very beginning, when he was Barack Obama's vice president, he was against this. Now he had a I think an irresponsibly optimistic vision of America, carrying out in perpetuity these counterterrorism operations based out of Afghanistan, which are just as unrealistic as anything else. But at least he said, we're not supposed to be in the nation building business. This isn't going to work. He was overturned by Barack Obama. Donald Trump agrees with Biden. Donald Trump said, we're not going to be in the nation building business. I'll give you generals a little bit of time to go in there and kick some butt. But at the end of the day, if you can't change the dynamic, we're getting out. And so Donald Trump initiated the process of getting out, and Joe Biden is finishing it, because at the end of the day, nation building will not work in Afghanistan.
So during the late 60s and early 70s, there was a groundswell in this country of anti-war protesters. How come, for the most part, American people did not protest what we were doing, sacrificing our young men and women, spending a ton of money? How come there was no groundswell of protest for this war?
Well, I think the history of the anti-war movement in the 60s and 70s shows that there were two major social events that took place, social economic events that took place during that time that helped feed the anti-war sentiment. One was the civil rights movement, and the notion amongst minority Americans and poor Americans that Vietnam was the poor man's war, that the blacks and the poor whites were being sent from the United States to fight this war, this unjust war. And then working hand in glove with that was the draft. The fact that all American men had skin equity, meaning there was a chance you were going to Vietnam. And when confronted with that chance and the fact that many of them ended up going to Vietnam, and many of those ended up dying and many more of those ended up being wounded, lives disrupted, et cetera, the society as a whole react with a viable, a vibrant, a vigorous anti-war movement. Now we fast forward to today, there are no equivalents. I mean, there was the Black Lives Matter movement over the last summer, but there's been no equivalent for the totality of our experience in Afghanistan. There is no draft. It's an all-volunteer military that goes over. And frankly speaking, the vast majority of Americans have no skin equity in this. They can turn on the TV, they can see things, but the numbers of dead coming back from Afghanistan are minuscule compared to other wars. The same thing with the wounded. So unless you have a loved one that's over there, the likelihood of you attending a funeral of somebody who died in Afghanistan is slim to none. The same with the likelihood of you knowing somebody who's been wounded in Afghanistan, slim to none. We're a nation of 320 million people. We've lost 2,400 dead. We've lost several tens of thousands of wounded. Those are tragic human figures, but in the grand scheme of things, it's nothing. And we live at a time when there is so much waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal government, when we have a military budget of $600-700 billion a year. The numbers in Afghanistan just weren't enough in terms of the money being spent. They weren't enough to make society wake up and take notice. There is no viable anti-war movement. You have a bunch of holdovers from the Vietnam era that hang out on street corners with signs that nobody cares about. They have no political viability. They have no capability of influencing public opinion or the vote or anything. They're pathetic little remnants that sit there and feel good by holding up a sign, but they accomplish nothing. And the only way you're going to get an anti-war movement is if enough Americans have equity in the conflict. And right now, they don't. The equity they do have is $2.4 trillion spent over the last 20 years. And the reality that had we diverted this money to programs here in America, so much could have been accomplished. But that's a theoretical spread over 20 years, and most Americans aren't able to grasp that, and it doesn't impact their daily lives. Every American wakes up in the morning and goes to work, or at least most Americans do. Many Americans have two jobs. Some Americans have three jobs. They struggle to make ends meet. And when they come home, they don't want to go from one struggle to another. Frankly speaking, to be a viable anti-war movement, you have to be able to sustain that with employment, with money, et cetera. Nobody wants to leave their job, stand the risk of getting fired at their work to go out and protest a war that they have no vested interest in. They don't care. They're not paying the price. They want to come home and wrap themselves in a cocoon of comfort. And so long as the government helps feed this cocoon of comfort, they're not going to break free of it. And that's the reality. The vast majority of Americans have been so dumbed down by, you know, the feel-good economy. You know, fast food, fast electronics, digital electronics, escapism. That's the diversion they seek. They're not going to go out there and march in the streets. There's no anti-war movement because, frankly speaking, the American people don't know enough about what's going on, and they don't care enough about what's going on to go out there and make the sacrifices necessary to have a politically viable anti-war effort.
You said that there's over $2 trillion spent on this war. The student loan debt crisis is nearing that, but yet the people who are suffering from student loan debt, they're not really forceful about wasteful spending or spending in other countries that will not produce any, you know, likable solution. Even those people have been silent on this, right?
No, I agree. The student loan debt, $1.6 trillion and growing, is a huge drain on this country. It's basically a strangling chokehold around, you know, generations of young Americans and their parents who are stuck with these crippling debts. And as a result, are unable to effectively integrate into the American dream, into the American economy. The money's just being sucked away and given to, you know, the Sally Mays and these and exorbitant interest rates. I mean, you borrow $60,000 to go to college, and 10 years later, you've paid $100,000 and you still owe money. So people that say, oh, they're just trying to get out of paying their debts. No, they paid their debt. They're just getting gouged right now. And the thing is, if we took that $2.4 trillion and used it to pay off student debts, it's not just a one-time transaction. It's not just eliminating $1.6 trillion in student debt. Now you've liberated these people who were buried by this debt to take the money that they were paying the lenders and to put that into the economy in a constructive way. You know, people don't see that. Nothing about Afghanistan was constructive. I mean, the money that we spent went to defense contractors and things of that nature, but it didn't help the local communities. It didn't help, you know, the local economies. Yeah, maybe if people woke up and saw it that way, they'd be out in the streets. But again, not too many people are engaged to the level necessary to accumulate this data, assess this data, process it, and act on it.
There's been talk in recent days on TV about, you know, the plight of women in Afghanistan and how they will be thrust back to, before we got into Afghanistan, and you and I have talked about the realities, just say when I asked you to do the show, talk about the realities for women in Afghanistan with the Taliban. Were they ever liberated like the media portrays it to be?
Well, first of all, people need to understand that the Taliban are not a foreign entity. The Taliban are an expression of Afghan reality. They're, you know, Pashto tribal elements that actually became empowered by resisting the corrupt warlords of the 1990s. The concept that the Taliban is this foreign entity. No, they are Afghan. They are part of Pashtun society. They're an expression of Pashto male dominance. The United States goes into Afghanistan and we create this artificial bubble in Kabul where suddenly women can shed the hijab, shed the burqa, wear Western clothes, go to universities, go to get makeup parlors, go and do X, Y, and Z. And everybody says, the women are so liberated. This is wonderful. Take one step outside of Kabul and they're back in the burqa. Not the hijab, the burqa, fully covered. Walking three steps behind the men, getting beaten and raped every night. And this is during the 20 years of American occupation. Afghan women did not have a good life under the American occupation. That is a bold-faced lie. We created an artificial bubble in Kabul, but for the rest of the country, it was garbage. Why do you think we created female engagement teams to accompany the frontline combat units into the villages? Because when we entered the villages, all the women were stuffed into one house, and the Afghan men wouldn't let us talk to them. And so we created female engagement teams to go talk to these women who were wearing burqas, who were being raped, who were being sold off in arranged marriages. Their life was garbage. There was no hope for them. They weren't getting educated. And we knew this because our troops were in the villages seeing this and indeed continuing this because we didn't do anything to change it. So everybody who's sitting there going, oh, we're condemning the – we condemned them for 20 years to this reality. The biggest crime we committed was giving them a false sense of hope by dangling the possibility of a better future through this artificial bubble that was called Kabul. That was never going to happen. That was never going to be sustainable. It was always going to fail. So, you know, while my heart goes out to those women who did take advantage of this artificiality, one of the saddest stories right now is the 25 girls of the Afghan robotics team, world champions, girls who got educated based upon the promise of, you know, the potential of that developed through American occupation. They went out and took action on it. They won a world championship, and now they're at the airport trying to get out because they're the ones who are going to pay the price. The educated women, the ones who believed in this potential, are going to pay the price. But the concept that all Afghan women have been condemned to this future is a bold-faced lie. because 98% of women in Afghanistan never were able to avail themselves of this opportunity. They were stuck in the villages. They were stuck in the provinces. They were wearing the burqas, and they were treated like crap while we were there. So this is a total myth, a total myth.
Wow. You know, a lot of the countries in that part of the world, there's Afghanistan and Pakistan, and, you know, not being knowledgeable about the language in that part of the country. What does Stan mean?
Well, Stan is just a, it's a, it's land. I mean, so Pakistan, land of the Pakistan, you know, the Paki, Uzbekistan. It's just basically an extension that's added on to land of the Uzbeks, land of the Tajiks, land of the Afghans, land of the Pakis, things
okay.
of that nature.
Okay. Now, what do you see is in store for the country now that we're pulling out?
Well, first of all, we're not out yet. Let me just point out the reality that, you know, Joe Biden is getting ready to send 7,000 American troops into Afghanistan. They're deploying every day. Today, I think, according to the briefing, there's 3,500. By the end of the day, there should be another 1,000 more, and we're going up to 7,000. So any concept of us being out of Afghanistan is, you know, it just hasn't happened yet. And not only that, our presence is increasing. And every time we increase our presence, that comes with greater risk. The most indefensible place in Afghanistan is Hamid Karzai International Airport in Kabul. It's the most indefensible place. We just put 7,000 Americans in the one place we literally can't defend. They can blow up the aircraft on the runway at any time they want to. They can shoot down airplanes and helicopters any time they want to. We put in 7,000 hostages. That's the reality. Right now, the Taliban are cooperating. Right now, things have calmed down a little bit. Right now, it looks like we're getting forces in, and we're getting people moved out. But even today, you know, the president has said that this mission will last until the end of August, August 31st. We're not there yet. A lot can go wrong between now and then. You know, what happens if we get another mad rush at the airport? What happens if we start shooting down Afghan civilians and the Taliban decide they have to intervene and we start killing the Taliban, and now the Taliban decide they're going to shut down the airport, which they will do instantly? Now we have 7,000 hostages. You know, this is a, this, if we can get out of this intact without losing significant American military life, and we can extricate tens of thousands of people, it will have been because of luck. Luck. Because this literally is one of the most dangerous situations the American military has found itself in decades. I mean, the potential of losing hundreds of thousands of American troops instantly, by the way. This would be like Custer's Last Stand, where they get swarmed and there's nothing they can do about it. When you have no ammunition, when you have no water, when you have no food, because there's no way to resupply them if you cut off the air, you can't fight. So I'm very, very concerned. That doesn't mean that it's going to happen. But as a military professional, you have to go through all of the contingencies, and we've put ourselves in a position where there is a real possibility for the worst possible outcome. And no military planner would ever willingly want to do this. But we have to, because we have no other choice, because we have mismanaged this entire withdrawal to such a degree that the only possible solution requires us to put thousands of American troops in imminent harm's way.
So ultimately, will this benefit or hurt President Biden?
Well, in theory, this should be the end of his presidency. This kind of embarrassment, national embarrassment. I mean, this this is even worse than Vietnam. You know, when Vietnam fell in 1975, you know, we had 3 years to digest peace with honor. When Richard Nixon first announced peace with honor in 1972, we had 3 years to digest it so that, you know, when Saigon fell, we were able to pretty much be over that. This is instantaneous. Nobody expected this. I mean, no politician, the American media didn't expect. The American people weren't prepared for this. And so in theory, this should be so devastating to Biden politically that his presidency is over. It doesn't mean impeached. It just means he is done as an effective president. He has lost all credibility to lead. That's the way it should work. But the American people right now are just so they're like cats in little laser lights, and you just flick a laser light one way, flick it, and the cat runs and chases after it. And that's the American people. Frankly speaking, if you didn't serve in Afghanistan and you don't understand the magnitude of what just occurred, I think that within a couple days, unless we suffer an absolute military disaster, you'll have moved on to something. They'll put on a reality TV show, and you'll see somebody, you know, is that man going to give this girl a rose? And that's suddenly going to become that which attracts you. We can throw another distraction out there, you know, in terms of domestic politics. So I don't think this is going to be as damaging to Joe Biden as it should be. You know, but the other thing is, it's not just about domestic American politics. The world is watching. And the United States has lost all credibility here, all credibility. And we'll have devastating consequences from a geopolitical standpoint, but those consequences will accrue over time in the coming years, and they will accrue in a manner which, unless you're focused on it, will be imperceptible to most Americans. So we're basically looking at the decline of the American empire. But the American people are blissfully unaware of this and will continue to be blissfully unaware of this.
Wow. So, Scott, our time is up, and I'm sure that we will have many other discussions about Afghanistan and other issues that come up. So you've been listening to Scott Ritter. I'm Cynthia Pooler. This is All Exits Closed. If you like this show, follow us on Twitter. Scott, thank you. I always enjoy talking to you. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Thanks.